listening to GNU World Order, episode 363. My name's Fatu. This episode, we continue our stroll through the Slackware package set. We most recently left off with AT-Top in the AT software series, and we'll pick up with iSpell. You don't have to have Slackware installed to get something out of this. If these applications aren't installed on your system already, they often are. Many of these are squirreled away on your system and you just don't realize that they're there. Then the ones that aren't there, you can probably find in your software repository of whatever distribution you're running. The first one that we're talking about today has high to mid likelihood of already being installed. It is iSpell. It's a spell checker. I guess people generally think of it as, you know, kind of the obligatory, quote, spell checker for your terminal, because it does kind of live in the terminal in some modes. It's actually a very flexible application. So I'll talk about the two ways that I know how of it sort of being used on its own, and then I'll talk a little bit just briefly how I interface with it, which is not through the terminal. So it'll be kind of interesting. This isn't sort of your system spell checker. This is an application dedicated to spell check. And that can cause some confusion or consternation sometimes, because I think there's an illusion on many operating systems or, you know, on a computer. A lot of people think, well, there's a system spell checker that manages all instances of spelling everywhere on my system. And I think that is the case in some operating systems. I don't know. I haven't looked into it deeply enough. I haven't made a study of spell checking. But on Linux, there is no such thing that I'm aware of. There may be some application that does do that, but I have not yet seen that myself, nor have I looked into installing such a thing. There are spell checkers for application, and in the case of iSpell, it is a dedicated spell checker. That is what it does. It checks spelling. Now, you can hook into it in other applications, so you may see iSpell pop up elsewhere, but your iSpell spell checker is different than your, for instance, LibreOffice spell check, and so on. Now, the reason I think this sometimes causes consternation is because one might think, well, there should be a user dictionary from which all spell checkers pull references, and that's an arguable thing to say. That is something that you might want to work toward. I don't know about formatting in all the different spell checkers. I don't know whether that aspiration is feasible. I mean, I guess it's probably feasible, even if there's some kind of, you need to write some kind of front end to translate your word list from one thing to another. I don't know how all of that would work. All I know is that iSpell is iSpell. It is one spell checker, potentially, of many different ones that you may have on your system. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not really prepared to say either way, because frankly, I've yet to see a system that truly lets the user take ownership of their spell checking word list. I know that, you know, if you do have a global spell checking system that somehow pervades all application, that's fine. But even in that case, even when something approximates that sort of global view, I don't know that I am convinced that users feel like they sort of own that word list and know where it exists and how to add words to it, or sometimes more importantly, how to remove words from it and so on. So I haven't quite seen people take that much control over the thing checking their spelling, and I'm not even sure that people care that much. I think that there's a subset of users who do care, and those are the people writing things that are subject to critique of some sort, like grading papers or you know, making a good impression at your job or your prospective job. But I don't know that I've seen really people think, okay, well, this is my word list and I'm going to carry that around in my home directory for the rest of my life. I mean, heck, I don't even know if I've seen that many people who are even aware that their user data exists in a single sort of definable place. You know, a lot of people don't even understand that their user data is within their home directory. You know, the concept of a home directory or a user directory, whatever they would be called on a different OS, that doesn't seem to be all that pervasive. So asking people to take ownership and to care about their word list, I think, would be a weirdly tall order. So all of that is to say, I'm just not sure how big of a deal spell checking is to most people, and certainly judging from things that I read day in and day out, it doesn't seem like a lot of people are really all that concerned all the time about how their spell checkers work, or whether they use a spell checker at all. So in order for this to use, to order for us to see iSpell, you'll need a demo file. So I'm just going to create a quick one here, demo.txt, and I'm going to type in how, you are listening to GNU World Order, but I'm going to spell listening incorrectly with an I instead of an E, so L-I-S-T-I-N-I instead of E-N-I. And then I'll say, this is a show, but I'll type T-H are both capital rather than just a capital T. This is a show about Linux, and I'm going to leave that lowercase, and open source, all one word, technology. We'll just see how that goes. Okay, so now I've got this demo file. I'm quickly going to copy it. I'll just chat demo.txt into demo.fresh. There, now I have a fresh copy whenever. So I'll type in iSpell space demo.txt. That takes over my screen in a little terminal UI. TUI, as some people phrase it, and at the top of the screen is the word that's being analyzed right now, and the first one that it caught was listening, the file that it is from, and then there's the workspace underneath that, which is the sentence from which the word comes, so you are listening to the New World Order, got it, and then a listing of potential replacements. So in this case, there is but one, zero, and it is listening, spelled with an E instead of an I. And then at the bottom of the screen is my menu. So it's a little bit cryptic, I guess. It says brackets, SP, close bracket. I honestly don't know what that is. And then it says number. So if I type in a number, for instance, zero, then it would accept listening as the correct spelling for that word. Other options include R for replace. So if it doesn't give me the correct option or whatever, then I can just replace. It's a manual override, right? Replace it with anything. Maybe I don't even want to use the word listening. Maybe I want to use the word hearing instead. There's also accept, which is telling it. And I feel like this is an odd term for this action, but accept means to essentially ignore the word from now on. So it's telling it to accept this word as the correct spelling, which is different from insert. Insert with an I, so if I hit I, this that would insert listening into my user dictionary. But accept just, it's basically skip. Skip this and all future occurrences of this word during this session. I don't know why they chose accept. I feel like that's an odd term for that. There's L to look it up. U for uncap. I have no idea what uncap means. Uncap is, it means accept the word and add an uncapitalized, actually all lowercase version to the private dictionary. Okay, I've learned something now. And then there's quit and exit. So that's those are our options for this. Okay, so if I'm just going to type in zero for this one, because that would be the correct spelling. And the next word that it catches is this, with capital T-H-I-S. So that's, mostly right. The spelling's right. The capitalization is wrong. And so it's suggesting zero, his, one, thin, two, thins, three, this. Weird. Weird that this came so low in that list, but whatever. So three, I hit three, and it automatically replaces it and moves it to the next word, which is Linux, with a lowercase l. It's suggesting zero, Linus, or Linus, and then one, Linux, with a capital L. That's the correct option. And then once again, open source technology. I think canonically, the correct adjective term for open source kind of as a brand is open space source. Technically speaking, it should be open dash source, which it also offers. But when you're talking about open source technology, the sort of the unquote brand, or the quote unquote brand of open source is just open space source. That's the whole file. And so it drops me back at my bash prompt. That's kind of the expected workflow, at least from the man page. That's what I get. That's kind of what's expected. That's the built-in, correct, canonical iSpell experience. But there's more. The other mode of iSpell is kind of a really handy instant lookup dictionary type thing. So if you just type in iSpell at your terminal, then you're in interactive mode, and it prompts you for a word. So if I do, for instance, open source, all one word, it says, how about open source, with a space, comma, open dash source. And so then, presumably, I could type in open space source, and it says that it's okay. Or I could do open dash source, okay. So it's happy with those. Let's do mnemonic. And it says, okay, I didn't actually think I would spell it correctly. Let's do it incorrectly. M-E-M-O-N-I-C. It says it's not found. Oh, I did M-E-N-O-N-I-C. That's a little bit too far off, I guess. I meant to do M-E-M-O-N-I-C. Mnemonic. Still says not found. So this is problematic, right? Because I'm really close. M-E-M-O-N-I-C. Oh, there it goes. Okay, I guess I see I did too many M's the first time. Wow, that's a tough word to misspell, apparently. So mnemonic, M-N-E-M-O-N-I-C, misspelled as mnemonic, M-E-M-O-N-I-C, correctly finds mnemonic, M-N-E-M-O-N-I-C, and gives me the options. It also gives me the option of demonic. That's a fun one. But I think what I'm trying to get at here is that I feel like it's maybe a little bit not forgiving enough, or maybe it doesn't take wild enough guesses sometimes for my liking. And I don't know, you know, I don't know the right, I don't know the fuzz factor, really, that is correct. Like, what is the right amount that you would want it to take wild guesses? That's got to be tough to program. So I get why that would not work, but I guess I would prefer it to just throw out wild ideas and guesses at what I might mean, especially with something like, for instance, mnemonic. I feel like all iterations of my misspelling should have triggered something, because it was, I don't know, to me that seems likely enough. Even if it had some search mode where it was just like, okay, here's a couple of words, maybe even starting with that letter, with the rest of just the vowels in that same order, maybe that would have produced something that would trigger me to think, oh, well, what I really meant was this one, or let me try something a little bit different. I guess I'm trying to say that I prefer some guesses than just a not found. Like, I feel like in a spell checker, I think I would rather never see the words not found as a result. I want something. But anyway, that's my opinion. And to get out of I spell interactive mode, control D gets you back to your prompt. And now really quickly, I'll just talk about the way that I normally use I spell, which is from Emacs. And when I'm using Emacs, I use iSpell as my spell checker. And in fact, I use Aspell for iSpell. So the built-in spell checker of Emacs is iSpell. But what people have told me, and I have not actually followed through and researched this myself, but people have told me in the past that Aspell deals with non-English documents better than iSpell does. Like I said, I haven't actually followed up on that. That is purely hearsay. I took them at their word when they told me that. I don't even remember who told me that. And so that's what I use. I use Aspell. Either way, the interface is the same, and you can open up a file and I guess I'll open up this demo file, except I'm going to open up the fresh one with all the misspellings in it. And so normally what I do is, like, if there's a word that I feel is off, then I just put my cursor over the word and do Alt-Shift-$. And for whatever reason, that's mapped to iSpell-word, I think it. And I get a little menu up at the top of all the suggestions. So once again, this is zero listening. Now, for the record, it does have more results than iSpell. You'll remember that iSpell gave me one suggestion, which was listening with an E. Correct. This one also gives me listening as zero, but then it gives me listing, glistening, destining. Is that a real word? Destining? Lusting, staining, stinging, stoning, and so on. So I'll back out of that for a moment. Now, if I wanted to do the whole document, which I do, you know, at the end of the document, generally, I just press Alt X, and then I just invoke it manually with the words iSpell-buffer, and that'll go through the whole thing line by line, word by word, and give me all the suggested correct spelling. And this one has found all of the same words and has given me all the correct suggestion, actually, for the record, as the zeroth choice, which is not always the case. I'm just starting to notice now that the difference between Aspell and iSpell is just kind of interesting too. But so that's it found all the same words. It gave me the suggestion. And all the options are the same. So for instance, you can accept, you can insert, you can replace, you can just choose the number. You know, all that stuff is pretty much the same as the iSpell interface. It's just you're viewing it through Emacs rather than going out to your terminal to do it as a dedicated action. And that's generally how I interface with iSpell, except it's not really iSpell, it's ASpell. But ASpell doesn't come installed by automatically on Slackware, I don't think, at least. Does it? I don't know. Maybe we've already covered it, or maybe we'll cover it in the future, but I'm pretty sure that's one that I had to install myself as sort of part of my Emacs doll. And there's a bunch of different packages within ASpell for the different languages, too. iSpell, I'm not sure about. I mean, I'm sure there must be for iSpell localization and all, but I don't know. It's a handy little spell-checking application, whether you use iSpell in as a command, whether you use it in interactive mode, or whether it or something similar in some other application like Emacs, it is a handy little spell checking routine that you can invoke and make sure that you actually are spelling things correctly, which is important. I love to think sort of that spelling, as long as the intent comes across, it's good enough. But at the same time, I think sometimes, you know, it is important to do a spell check because it's technology and we have that ability. So why not just be that much more precise in how we communicate? Lately, I think communication, we've demonstrated successfully in this world that communication can be suboptimal if you don't really give it the extra attention. And I think spell checking sometimes is one way to just really make sure that everyone's kind of talking the same language and we're all sort of thinking about the words that we're choosing and we're choosing them for what they mean rather than for what we think they mean and so on. So spell checking, so I don't know. I think it's a good thing. I do. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world if you misspell something. I really don't. I'm just saying, because there's technology to make sure that you don't misspell stuff, I think it's worth doing. Okay, so that was iSpell. It's a bigger topic than what I've just given it. I mean, I could go on about it because, I mean, what about exclusions? What about words that you don't want spell checked? How do you deal with that? Do you just add it to your user dictionary? Do you just do it and you just accept it every session? Is there some kind of word list separate from your user dictionary? How about words in brackets, like tags in XML or in HTML and so on? This is all, I mean, it's a big, you know, actually a big topic that you don't really think about all the time, but eventually you kind of do have to get around to it because you realize that, yeah, sometimes words are more complex in a technical setting than one might think. What I normally do, and there are a couple of different modes in Emacs that help iSpell or ASpell ignore things in bracket or in tags, in what are they called, greater than, less than symbols, whatever those things are, angle brackets. So that's useful. And then otherwise, especially in sort of the tech space, there's just so many wonky and weird words that we invent. So I just end up adding them all to my user dictionary. And there's a bunch of weird words and in a bunch of RPG things too, tabletop games that pop up on my system a lot that I just add to my user dictionary. Who cares? I'll just add everything. And in the one or two times that I'm actually not using it the way that I used it in some other context, that's fine. I'll deal with it later. And that's iSpell for you. It's a very useful tool. You should use it, honestly. I mean, you shouldn't have to worry about your own spelling. That's what computers are for. It's just that we do have to invoke it. I think there is that interesting problem of, you know, in a lot of settings, it gets invoked for us. You know, in LibreOffice, for instance, if you spell something incorrectly, it'll get underlined with that big red jagged line. And that doesn't necessarily happen elsewhere. So you do have to invoke this yourself. In Emacs, there are a couple of modes that will invoke it sort of on the fly. It's called fly spell. So you could start using that if you're someone who types in not LibreOffice, such as myself. But other times, you just have to remember to make that part of your workflow. I have made git hooks for iSpell. I have done make files that call iSpell. You know, it is something that, yes, you can forget. You should not forget. Okay, that's iSpell, really. Now let's talk about ITS tool. ITS is the internationalization tool set or something like that. I should look that up. Internationalization tag set. Sorry. By W3C. I'll link to the schema in the show notes. It's It's quite clever, actually. So the problem is, if you look at a document, a lot of times you wouldn't know necessarily what needs to be translated and what doesn't be translated. For instance, something that's quite important, like a color name, like well, here's in their example, Navajo white. That's what the background color is, Navajo white of this imaginary application. And if you're looking through that and you're translating it into a local language, you may or may not know that Navajo white needs to be translated or not. Does it need to be? Is it a word that needs translation, or is it a special word that does not, that in fact must not be translated, or else things will break? Well, ITS is a tag set that helps programmers specify things that do and do not need to be translated. So, for instance, instead of having string, tag string close tag Navajo white close string tag, so it was string with angle brackets and then Navajo white and then close string tag. Instead of having that, you'd have string, the tag, and then space ITS colon translate equals quote no unquote close that and then Navajo white close the tag. And that would be a way for your translation team to know not to touch that value. That's not to be translated. It's something that's special and apart from their normal workflow. Now that's all XML. PO stands for, I think, portable object, and a POT file, a portable object template file, is a thing that you could hand out to your translators. And they'd be able to look at that and work off of it and sort of complete fill in the blanks, really, is what it would do. So, and this is all, by the way, more or less hearsay. I don't know. I don't do this in real life myself. So I'm speaking highly theoretically and or not theoretically, but I mean I'm summing it up as best I know how. There may be some details here that I'm not super clear on, and I'll try to be clear about what I'm not clear on, and one of those is the use of a PO file. I know that PO very often is generated when compiling something, and it's in a language or a region that isn't the same as the region that the programmer assumed you were in, and so the PO file gets generated. Or maybe the PO file gets generated because you have several different languages active on your system, and so you're going to need those PO files in case you switch over to French all of a sudden from English or whatever. So the PO file and the POT file, I don't actually use those myself, so I'm not 100% sure on sort of the workflow around them. But nevertheless, ITS tool can look at an XML file written with the ITS schema in mind, and then formulate a PO template file .pot file for your translation team. So the simple syntax here is ITS tool ITS.xml. For instance, that's what I called it. You call it example.xml, whatever. I called it ITS.xml, and then dash o for output, or even dash dash out, and we'll just call it out.pot, out.pot. And then if I look at this file in, for instance, Emacs out.pot, I see that I've got some header information here at the top. So it tells me the creation date of this POT file, and then the PO revision date. I can fill that in myself. Last translator, it prompts me, or it sort of clues me in on, put your full name here and your email address here. So it's got a language team, put your language here, and so on. So it's got everything sort of that you would expect, all that sort of boilerplate stuff at the top. And then as you scroll through, you see the different things that need translated. So for instance, here's the ITS tool path variables slash string. It is an ITS.xml line 13. Message ID is quote corporate policy. Message string quote quote. So that's an empty string. So if I go back over to my XML file, I see that in the variables in a section called homepage, no, not in arguments, under arguments in variable, there is a string its translate equals no policy, all capital policy. So that, notice, I didn't see in my translation document. There is no policy to trans, but the next line is string corporate policy, and there's nothing saying not to translate that. There's no ITS attribute here telling me not to translate that. And so that's why it pops up in my POT file. Message ID is corporate policy. So then I would put whatever translation I wanted to place here in the quotation mark, and I would save that file, and I would keep going through, and there's, you know, it'll list everything that has not been marked not translatable, and the translator would fill those in. And that's kind of, as far as I know, that's more or less the workflow. As I say, I don't do this in real life, so there might be some subtleties I'm missing out on, but that's sort of the rough idea. There are a couple of different flags for this. There's dash dash ITS to load a specific ITS rule. I don't know anything about that. There's dash dash no dash built-ins, and that is not to apply the built-in ITS rule that ships with ITS tool. So I'm assuming here between those two options that a new schema might come out sometime, but that doesn't mean you have to update ITS tool. You simply point it to the new scheme or whatever they call it in the ITS world. I mean, I'm assuming it's a schema, but maybe there's some other subtleties there that I'm aware of. Dash dash strict tells it to exit with an error when there is broken XML. Dash dash load dash DDT loads an external DDT for XML stuff. And then there's keep entities and param, so you can specify specific parameters, name and value pair. And that's the tool. That's ITS tool. It's for internationalization / localization. It's very important. It's just not a tool that I actually use in real life, so I don't have a whole lot to say about it. But it's always great. I mean, this is the kind of markup language, this is the advantage of markup languages. You know, this is why we have things like XML, something that is admittedly quite verbose, quite ugly. It's sometimes hard to parse if you're not used to looking at it all the time, but boy, is it just so flexible. It really is. It's just so nice. And I'm a big fan of XML. I know a lot of people dislike it, and I'm with you. Like, I get it. I totally get it. Sometimes XML can be exceedingly frustrating, but I think ultimately the design of XML is kind of brilliant. It's just so predictable, so rigid and strict, and it really, really makes, it gives a lot of confidence to the person generating the XML that whoever is going to process it on the other side is going to be able to get it into whatever format they want. And that's such a great sense of security for me, and I imagine for many, many others, because, you know, there are lots of other languages out there that are less strict, but then the parsing of that language or of that schema, of that system of writing is a lot harder. It becomes really, really, well, not, you know what, it's not that it's harder. That's a dangerous sort of precedence to set, that XML parsing is easy, because it's not. I mean, there's all kinds of weird stuff you have to do. There's XPath, there's XSL, there's all kinds of weird things that you might have to get involved with to parse this stuff. That's not necessarily fun or easy. However, it is reliable. It's reliable and predictable, and that's what you need. Sometimes there, you don't have to guess at the parsing. You don't have to think, now, when this person did 3 space indent here, did they mean for it to be this kind of block, or did they just put 3 spaces there? And if they put accidentally 6 spaces, so 2 sets of 3 spaces, are they trying to be in the same block? Are they starting a new sub-block? And is that sub-block a child of the original one, or is it meant to be a different block, its own parent, but further indented? You know, it's endless, and trying to parse that isn't that it's difficult to parse, it's that it's ultimately impossible to parse computationally, programmatically. You can't do it, because the intent just isn't there. There's no final word on what the intent was, whereas XML, if the intent is not clear, it does not validate and it does not process, and you go fix it. That's a beautiful system. Now granted, that might be, you know, that might just be, well, maybe we just need to turn quirks mode off on other languages. You know, like, if we're not clear on how markdown is meant to be parsed, then, or HTML, when we don't pose a tag, but we parse it anyway, like, maybe the right answer is to stop activating quirks mode and stop guessing and just tell the user, hey, this isn't right, you need to fix it, and then I'll parse. But XML, I don't know, there's a certain, with that verbosity and that level of explicit intent, I tend to think that it's if you write XML, you don't feel like you're gonna revisit it in 3 or 5 or 10 years and think, well, now I have to rewrite this because nothing parses XML or you know, I don't know what this means now. It's like, no, you know exactly what it means. And if you have to untangle it, then you can, because it contains its own little map of what everything is supposed to be. And that's a wonderful, wonderful. So yeah, I'm a fan of XML. By extension, I guess ITS tool is cool. That's what got me started on that passionate support of XML. It is now time for passionate support of coffee. Go get yourself a cup. We'll meet back here and continue on our journey. Next up is Jed. This is the this for me is the exciting stuff because it's text editors and shells, not Jed actually, but so Jed is a text editor, but it necessarily demands a discussion of slang, which also gets into an interactive shell for slang, which is cool and weird. And then there's, after Jed, there's going to be like Joe, and then there'll be Joe, and then there'll be Corn, the Corn Shell. So very exciting things coming up, but I think now that we have coffee, now that we have Jed, we'll just kind of think this will probably be the last half of the show. So if you're not up for a lot of discussion about text editing, then just enjoy your coffee. So, okay, so Jed, it is, let's see, what's this guy's name? John E. Davis's text editor. That's what Jed stands for, John E. Davis, I guess. Or maybe it's, yeah, no, I think it's Jed. And Jed is meant to be, well, a text editor first and foremost, I guess. It says that it emulates Emacs, EDT, WordStar, and Brief editors. I've only heard of one of those, and it is the Emacs one. No, actually, sorry. I've heard of WordStar, but I have no experience with it. I don't know what it is. I know people I've heard that mentioned at one point. So Emacs is the emulator that I use, and it is the default emulator. That's the one that by default in the Jed RC file that ships with Jed. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But so for me, this is just a handy little lightweight Emacs clone that's useful to have, because lightweight Emacs clones are useful. There are actually quite a few of them out there, but the ones that ship with Slackware are the ones that I guess the ones that I'm most familiar with, maybe, arguably. I don't know. There's a micro Emacs out there, and I've been using that on a server for quite some time. So yeah, they're useful little things, and it is kind of funny because you do realize just how reductionist you can be. You know, for an Emacs clone, nine requirements out of 10 are can I invoke things with Control X and then some other control character. Like that dominates your list of requirements. You know, no matter how much you sit around and tell yourself, oh, I like Emacs because it's got this one cool feature and this other cool feature, and it's got this mode and that mode. At the end of the day, at least for those quick Vim-like actions that you do on a server or just in the terminal, and because you can't be bothered in your root, and so you can't easily fire up a GUI application without giving yourself extra permissions or something. So you just want something that's lightweight, easy to compile, has the correct Emacs key binding, and that's it. That's what you want out of a lightweight Emacs clone. And that's what Jed provides, really. But the similarities, I guess, really technically stop there. And keep in mind that the Emacs emulation is but an emulation. It is simply, we'll use this set of definitions for the keyboard shortcuts. That's mostly what you get from your Emacs emulation mode. So Jed, really, possibly, I mean, I don't want to speak for Jed or Mr. Davis, but I think in a way, Jed is a proof of concept, or maybe that's not quite enough. Maybe it's more like a showcase for this scripting language that John E. Davis created back in 1992 called Slang, or Slang, maybe. I don't know how he says it, but Slang is this library that helps people create interactive applications. Apparently it is C-like, it is object-oriented, or rather it has support for object-oriented model, and I guess in many ways it's meant sort of as a scientific computing sort of front end. And there is an SLang shell called SLSH, which also does ship with Slackware, so we will be talking about it. It's a nice little robust library. So this is kind of SLang in action. And as proof of concepts go, I think it's actually pretty good. So if you launch JED, J-E-D, then you get a scratch buffer. That's familiar to any Emacs user. It says that, hey, this isn't going to be saved. But luckily, it prompts you down at the bottom of the window that kind of, it doesn't necessarily force you to do what it's prompting you to do. You can switch back up to your scratch buffer, but it does prompt you for a file name, as if to say, to get started using this application, you should really create a file. And that is a critique sometimes of Emacs, is that initial scratch buffer, because it's there, and it's so tantalizingly simple, and you can just start typing, and then you wait 3 minutes, and you forget that it's just a scratch buffer. And so you type and type and type, and then you, forgetting that it's a scratch buffer, maybe you hit Control X, Control C, and you close Emacs, and everything you've typed goes away, because the scratch buffer does not prompt you to save it when you're closing, but it's a scratch buffer. Its sole purpose is to be a scratch buffer. If you exit, it pretends like the scratch buffer doesn't exist, it doesn't care. And so really that initial touching of the file is so important, and it's a difficult little push and pull for me, even, because I feel like best practice is to force the user to make the file for their own good, and yet the convenience of that scratch buffer, I have to admit, I do it all the time. So what's the right answer? I don't know. Maybe a bunch of temp files in a designated location on your hard drive, to which Scratch always saves, and you just go back and clear that out on a periodic basis, every 30 days or something. That's not a bad idea. You should write an Emacs plugin to implement that. Either way, JED does have a scratch buffer, but it defaults to placing you at the bottom of the window in this interfile name buffer, and I'm just going to call it jed.txt. So now we're in an empty file, and it loads, and it tells me that it has loaded from user share jed lib text mode.el. EL .sl. See, I'm already thinking I'm in Emacs because I'm giving things the default ellipse file extension. Okay, so the cool thing about JED, I guess, is that, well, one of the cool things is that for me, it is very much, it looks like Emacs, and because the key bindings are familiar, most of them, it feels like Emacs. But one nice thing is that up in the upper left-hand corner, it says F10 key, and then points to the window, to the menu. So if I hit F10, then it highlights the first menu selection, which is a file, and I can hit return, and it opens the menu, and then it shows me all the different options. So open, Control X, Control F, close, nothing for that. Save, Control X, Control S, save as, Control X, Control W, and so on. I can scroll over one with the right arrow, and it takes me to the edit menu, and it shows me all the different options there. Search, buffers, window, system help, and so on. So it kind of tells you how to get into that menu, which I always thought was kind of nice. It doesn't exactly tell you how to get out of it, but escape works. I think Control G probably works. Yes, it does. So either Control G or escape, which I feel, well, if you're Emacs, certainly Control G is intuitive. Escape, I think that's somewhat intuitive for many users. So there you go. That's JED. It's a file. It's a text editor. It takes after Emacs in lots of different ways. And the similarities aren't just in look, feel. It really, a lot of the functionality, I mean, I don't know where functionality starts and feel ends, but like whatever you think of, like JED kind of, like if you're in your Emacs mode, then JED kind of complies. It often surprises me just how many similarities there are. So for instance, Control X, Control F, that'll open up a file. I'm going to open up the demo.fresh file. It detects that there was an autosave file. So that's kind of amazing. I'm not going to load that, but the fact that it knew that is kind of cool. And I mean, to be clear, that's an autosave from Emacs. So it's not an autosave from Jed. I wasn't using Jed earlier. I was using Emacs to type that demo file. So the fact that Jed could recognize that, hey, there's a file with some characters after it that's an autosave of this one, that's really neat. So if I go over to you are listening, oh, that's a problem. Alt F kind of doesn't work because it jumps up to the menu, but I'm sure there's a way to turn that off. You are listening, so then if I do Alt Shift dollar sign, then it spell checks just as I would have expected. And I can hit zero to complete that word and go over to other words and so on. So all the keyboard shortcuts that I'm expecting are working more or less. Like I say, the Alt F jumping up to the file being a little bit problematic, but not uncommon. I mean, I've had terminals that also have the same problem. Control S to save, Control W to save as, Control C to quit, and so on. So yeah, all the basic functionality is there, definitely. But buffer management is also there. So if I'm in one buffer, I can Control X O to go to another buffer, Control X 2 to split the buffer horizontally, or I guess technically, what is that? Yeah, it's a horizontal split, meaning that they're stacked and that they're one is on top of the other, one is above the other, and so on. So there's a lot of functionality here that you wouldn't necessarily expect a mere emulated, you know, sort of not even a clone, just an emulation of something. You wouldn't expect it to necessarily work that well. And get it done. Now, it doesn't have a vertical split that I know of. It doesn't have a, no, actually it does. It has a shell. So if I do Alt X shell, I think it was. Yep, it invokes a shell written, I guess, in S-lang. So that's kind of neat. It has, well, I mean, all of the functions, of course, are accessible by Alt-Hack, which is quite nice because that's, again, what I would expect in Emacs. Anything that's not bound to a key, I would expect to be able to access through Alt-Hack or Meta-X tech. Okay, so that's pretty cool to play around with, and it is quite small. I wanna emphasize that. Let's look at, I mean, this isn't totally accurate, but let's just do a disk, a DU on Jed. That's 312 kilobytes for Jed. Now, there's a bunch of SLAM extensions or, you know, add-on that are hanging out that doesn't account for. So that's not perfectly accurate to say that it's a mere 312K, but it is pretty simple. And if you do an LDD on Jed, you get you don't get a whole lot of things that it relies on. It needs libslang and it needs incurses. And then other than that, it kind of just needs the normal sort of normal things that you would find on a Linux system. Libc, obviously, libdl, libm, libgpm, and libvdso. I guess it's possible you might not have some of those things like gpm, but I'll bet that's an optional thing that you could do at compile time anyway. I've not compiled Jed myself. I just use it straight out of Slackware. But other little Emacs clones I have compiled myself, and they generally tend to be pretty simple. I mean, that's kind of part of the design, part of the, I think, the reason that they exist, really. It's not just the design, it's just a lot of times people want the experience without all the bloat. And Emacs is super bloated. I mean, it's a huge application. Like, if you just grab the sources for Emacs and compile it, it will take you all day. I mean, if you didn't do your homework and look at all the dependencies, because there it depends on so much stuff by default. Like, it wants libpoppler, it wants libsvg, it wants png, it just wants everything, like all kinds of crazy stuff. And the fact that you can grab an Emacs, you know, sort of, again, just kind of 80% of the way there, Emacs experience. And it's funny, like I said, how skewed that is. 80% of Emacs is not just keyboard shortcuts and buffer management. And yet that's like in practice, when if you're not living in that application and you just need it for that quick edit, then the 80% is exactly that. It's just the keyboard commands, really. So that's Jed. Now let's take a really quick look at Jed's jedrc file, because that's pretty interesting to look at. So you can put in your init file a .jedrc file in your home directory, but by default Jed ships with one in /user/share/jed/lib/jed.rc. So let's have a look at that really quick, and it's heavily commented. which is useful. But if you scroll through, you'll kind of get an idea of how all of this works. For instance, eval file seems to be a function to load in a thing, to load in a file, an extension, a plugin, whatever we're calling, an slang extension. So for instance, if we have parentheses, parentheses equals eval file, parentheses, quote, Emacs, close quote, close parentheses, semicolon, that ensures that the Emacs P bindings are loaded. Now, you could also do that same call for instance, EDT, for EDT emulation. Again, I don't actually know what that is. IDE for a Borland IDE emulation mode. I've heard of Borland, but I don't know. I didn't know that they had an IDE. Brief, WordStar, and CUA. So CUA, I forget what that stands for, but CUA is a mode in Emacs to enable control C to copy, control V to paste, control X to cut in context, because obviously control X to cut would interfere heavily with the default key bindings of control X, control F, or control X, control C, whatever. So if you have something selected or marked, then when you do control X, it cuts. And that's obviously quite useful for people who aren't used to Emacs, or who are used to Emacs but thinks it's stupid that Emacs hasn't accounted for modern key bindings. But I mean, it has CUA mode. You turn that on and you're good to go. Okay, another thing that I've already observed, Alt F or Escape F or Meta F, whatever, to move forward by a word rather than, for instance, a character. Well, in GED, that triggers the menu function, and that's not what we want. I'd prefer to keep menu as just F10. Well, the call for that, or the function for that, rather, is enable underscore menu underscore keys, parentheses, parentheses, semicolon. Now, if we comment that out here, the next time we run GED, we would find that our Alt F action no longer gets us into the menu. We would have to hit F10 to get in. And this is kind of the way that you would customize GED, really, is you'd latch on to a function or a hook that performs some action that you appreciate, and maybe you would assign it to a key binding, or maybe you would have it auto-load upon starting GED, and so on. You can get a feel for everything that's written into GED by going to F10 for the menu, pressing H for help, or just the right arrow over to help. Describe function is the menu entry. It takes you down to the little mini buffer at the bottom of the window, and you can hit tab several times until you get a list in the bottom half of your GED window of all available functions. That's, I mean, maybe there's some other way to get this, but I mean, that's the quick and dirty, and the only reason, the only way I know how to get it is the way I've just demonstrated. Well, I mean, I guess you could go look at the source code too, but these are all the hooks that are built in, or functions that are built into GED. I mean, it's quite a lot. There are quite a lot of them, and they're from the most basic to you know, quite complex, really. And all of them, of course, can be assigned to any number of key bindings or other functions. You know, you can put this stuff into your init file and have all kinds of things happen for you. So that's good to know about. I mean, just a couple of samples. Go down one, go left one, go right on, see what else. Create, well, dir-ed, that's an important one. That's the directory view of a file system within the GED window, which is a lot like, well, Emacs dir-ed. And then there's, for instance, here's the shell underscore command. So yeah, lots and lots and lots of different available functions there. And then, like I say, there are also hooks that have been created already for you, which frequently can be invoked through a key binding. And if you go to the help menu and you describe key bindings, then you'll find a lot of them defined there. So for instance, beg underscore of underscore line, probably the beginning of a line, right? So if I open up a sample file and I move my cursor to the end of the line, control E, I've just invoked EOL underscore command. It's not very consistent naming scheme, is it? And then if I hit control A, then it's beg of line. So now if I just hit Alt X or Meta X or Escape X and then type in EOL underscore CMD, then my cursor moves to the end of the line. So that's not the most efficient way to do something, but it is a way to do a thing, to test out a hook and put it to a key binding, for instance, if you want to. That's sort of basic hackery of Emacs, that sort of thing. That's the way, you know, that you're, when you're just figuring out the simple things within Emacs, that's at least for me, that was the workflow, you know, find out what functions are getting called when I do some magical key combination, and then go to my init file and redefine that, or overwrite it with something else, or amend it, or whatever. And I can see you doing the same thing with Jed. Now, Jed is written in Slang, as I've said, and so if you wanted to really hack on Jed and customize it for yourself, then definitely just, if you look into Slang, start programming your own functions, then you can load them into Jed and redefine how it behaves. So it is a very hackable editor, just like Emacs. It's just, instead of learning Lisp, you'd be learning, or ELISP, I guess, you'd be learning Slang. And Slang is a little bit more C-like than certainly Lisp-like, so it'll have a different feel to it. You'll probably be a little bit more on your own. I don't know how much of a scene there is for Slang hacking and Jed hacking. There might be a huge one, I don't know, but certainly with Emacs, you can generally expect to see people already having done what you think you wanted, much less get help on something. Whereas Slang, I'm not sure that you might have to find the people that, I'm not saying they don't exist, I'm just saying that I don't think it's going to be as readily available as something as big as, but that's Jed. It's a great little application. It's one of my many fallbacks. And by that, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Vim or Vi, for two reasons. One, because I use a Dvorak keyboard, and primarily a Dvorak keyboard. I guess I technically could use a QWERTY keyboard somewhere, but generally I just kind of default to the Dvorak keyboard. And so Vi or Vim, whatever, doesn't really work that well with that. I guess I could probably spend time redefining keys and so on, but Emacs is big, it's bloated, it's heavy, it's got way too many functionalities in it for that sort of simple, quick edit. And indeed, back before I switched to Dvorak, and I was very much, sometimes Vim, sometimes Emacs type person, it was very, very common, like very common, to edit my .emacs file in Vim, because number one, you didn't have to launch Emacs to edit your .emacs file, but also because if you're editing your .emacs file, it might be because something's broken. So launching Emacs and then dealing with the eternal questions of, you know, question after question, oh, this is broken, are you sure you want to continue, or whatever, that gets to be a pain. So getting out of the Emacs ecosystem and into something else in order to edit your Emacs environment is useful. So I would do that very frequently. And I think I've heard other people kind of laugh about doing the same thing themselves. So I don't think that was uncommon. And now that I do use Dvorak and kind of feel like Vim just isn't something I ever launch anymore, it kind of dawned on me that I didn't have to have Vim on my system. I could just remove it. And so I did. I removed Vim entirely and installed and regularly install either Jed or Joe or Micro Emacs, but generally for this purpose it's either Joe or Jed for my Vim replacement. And it works like a charm, because that way I get this nice little tiny minimal environment. I can type into it using keyboard commands that I'm used to and kind of feel like that, to get that experience of Emacs without having to actually launch the entirety of. So take a look at Jed if you're looking for a lightweight version of Emacs, or if you're just looking for a nice little terminal editor that isn't Emacs or Vim or Nano. That was the other one, Nano. Because Jed's pretty nice. It really is. It's quite nice. And if you're really curious about those niche fringe programming languages, Slang could be something fun to spend the weekend toying around with, for sure. I think that's everything. We've made some progress. We got through all the I's, and we've made progress into the J's. So next week we'll do Joe and Jove, and who knows, maybe we'll get to Corn Shell. You never know. We'll see. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network usually in channels such as Offcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is NotKlaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Put your hands on the radio right now.